utterly gorgeous area. I always like coming up here. I kind of sneak up here whenever there's an open house. I come up to this area and just look around, take pictures. Absolutely gorgeous. So let's look at your top voted questions from PollGab. The top voted one is wildly off topic. Oh, hold on here. I think I lost cell signal while I was chatting with you there. Let's try that again. Bookmarks, PollGab. Cell phone signal's a little sketchy up here. So the top voted question is from Sun Ra, which must have something to do with music. I'm shamelessly, I don't know that, but asks, who is your favorite musician? My musical tastes are all over the place. I like everything from electronic dance music to country to pop to K-pop, classical, all kinds of stuff. The thing that's in my rotation most heavily right now is an electronic dance music artist called John Summit, because I'm going to a John Summit. Just got back from, oh, actually, I'm wearing the t-shirt. Groove Cruise. They do this electronic music dance cruise. And he headlined that, and I'm going to see him in Vail, Colorado this coming weekend. So that'll be tons of fun. But I'd say that's my number one. Number two's probably better than Ezra. I still like them quite a bit. Next top voted question is from Dopinder, who says, "What is your opinion of the query hint tool in Management Studio?" I love it. I blogged about it. If you search for Brent Ozar SSMS query hint recommendation tool, I walk you through it. I explain who the target audience is. I explain when you should probably give it a shot. I think it's one of those things that is going to kind of pass by at the same time AI is coming in. And I don't think the recommendation hint tool is ever going to get the traction that it probably deserves, because I think people are going to be more likely to just try things like Copilot instead. But it was a good idea. It was interesting. The other problem with it is it actually runs the query with different hints. And so the longer that your query takes, the longer the recommendation hint will take, will a tool will take in order to do its thing. So if you have a query that runs for 5 minutes and then the hint tool wants to try 20 different sets of hints, well, you could be in for a 2 hour ride. So that's the only kind of drawback with that there. Next up, Trushit says, "I need a medallion architecture for my BI initiative. What would be your thought process?" I don't get into database design at all, much less things like medallion architectures. It's just not my bag. The person that you want to Google for, oh, it's going to kill me that I don't remember his name now, works for Microsoft, James Serra. James Serra, Serra. James Serra wrote a book called The Modern Data Warehouse, and he's got real big on community contributions. He happens to work for Microsoft, so of course, you know, he's going to come from a Microsoft kind of advice. But if you're looking for that kind of advice on stuff like medallion architectures, he's a great place to start. The other person to Google would be Patrick LeBlanc, LeBlanc. Patrick just recently had a video that popped up on my YouTube recommendations that was talking about how medallion architectures aren't really a good fit for a lot of people. Patrick's brilliant. He also works for Microsoft and has a great way of communicating. I really enjoy his videos. Check that one out. Next up, I graduated MIT says, "In the Mastering Index Tuning class, you say developers only need clustered indexes on their tables as a starting point." That's true. "And then database administrators should take over once the app is in production and then tune indexes based on application usage." That's correct. He says, "Does AI change that, and should devs use AI to predict indexes earlier?" I don't think it changes that. I still don't think you should try to guess your way through non-clustered indexing before an application goes live, because you just can't predict how users are going to use an application. Now, there is one exception. For those of you who haven't been through Mastering Index Tuning, that's indexing your foreign keys. And we talk about why that makes sense. But if for this person who's gone through the MIT class, no, I would do what the class says. I do think AI makes sense later in the process after the app has already gone live. But I just hate seeing people waste time guessing on non-clustered indexes when within the first day or two of it going live, you'll see what the most read-intensive queries are, you'll see what SQL Server's index recommendations are, and it'll just save you so much time. I've seen so many people spend cycles wasting their guesses trying to think of how a user's going to use an application and then just be completely wrong. Next up, let's see here. Bandhu says, there it goes. SQL log shipping performance can be bad over cloud SMB storage options. I would zoom out a little there and I'd say cloud log shipping can be tough in the cloud for a whole variety of reasons, not just the storage provider. It can also be your networking, your settings, things like that. He says, what's your opinion of swapping out the default log shipping transport to using something more network efficient like blob storage for Azure or S3 for Amazon? What I would say is there is no silver bullet because you can configure S3 storage or Azure blob storage poorly too. They have throughputs. Amazon's blob storage is a real pain in the rear end because it has storage limits per storage account, per volume target that you're at, and you really end up having to stripe it across a bunch of different volumes. I'm not saying they're bad. Any one of those can be faster, but it really depends on you doing your own troubleshooting in your particular environment. For example, I have one client who maintains a fleet of EC2 VMs with local NVMe storage. The backups are initially written to there first, then distributed across other NVMe boxes. Those are blazing fast in their case because they put a lot of work into troubleshooting and tuning that. I have another company that has thousands of SQL servers that uses Azure Blob Storage because at that scale, it's easier to maintain than trying to deal with file copy instances going around across a bunch of VMs. So it just really all depends on where you end up tuning things, putting the work into tuning. But I don't have a blanket recommendation. Rachel says, do you have a specific industry or sector of clients that you prefer over others, like healthcare, finance, education, etc.? Oh, I never thought about that. No, I would say my favorite is usually new industries that I've never worked with before. Like I get genuinely like schoolboy excited at the prospect of working with a business that I've never seen before. I'll give you an example. About 6 months ago, 12 months ago, somewhere in there, I got called into a company that does factory assembly line software. They were designing a brand new database from scratch. Just a little while ago, I told you I don't do a lot of database design, but this is a transactional database getting ported from an existing database, so it made sense there. So I got to go to their place where they made the software and they're like, hey, right down the street, there's a factory that makes cars. Let's go there and you can see firsthand how our software is used, where the database comes into play, and some different things that happen on the assembly line that make sense as to why we have to do it a certain way in the database. That was incredible. I got to tour a factory that was putting together parts for, I can't say the name of the cars, but putting together car parts, and it was incredible, assembling big, huge parts of cars. It was fantastic. I love stuff like that. Next up, Rojo asks, can you comment on the use of BitLocker on a SQL Server host? I'm concerned about speed, and it's another layer to add when I'm patching or updating. Is it really needed if a host is physically locked in a rack and room? So as a data professional, what you probably can't do is override your security team asking for less security. You got to know when to pick your battles, like when to hold them, when to fold them. You going up against a security team asking for less stuff is unlikely to succeed. They will tell you, shut up, meatbag, and just do what you're told. So what I would say is if you're in a small company where there's not a lot of security people and you actually have some impetus in this, what I would do is I would use transparent data encryption. SQL Server's built-in transparent data encryption encrypts the stuff before it hits the disk. So that way, if somebody nefarious takes backups, the data is encrypted inside the backup. Whereas with BitLocker, if someone takes a SQL Server backup to a URL, that's a capability that's built into SQL Server now, they can back up to URL and the database is not encrypted there. So BitLocker doesn't really buy you anything. If you have a small enough company and a small enough security team, you may be able to argue for the use of TDE instead. But if you don't have that either, then you're probably going to be stuck using BitLocker. Do I have any feelings on it? No. In any client that I work with, we would have used transparent data encryption long ago because it just makes much more sense. Alice asks, AI sent me down a PowerShell rabbit hole of try this, oh wait, sorry, try that, only to tell me many attempts later that what I was asking for is no longer supported. What is the worst AI rabbit hole you've ever experienced? Because I hit those really early on in the use of AI, what I'll do right away is from the very first thing that AI tells me, I'll say, can you give me a reason that wouldn't work? Or in the case of using things like Claude Desktop these days or GPT Codex, just hook up a local SQL server and you can say, okay, now test that hypothesis and see how it works. And you can just have the AI tool try it itself in a sandboxed environment and very rapidly come to the realization that that thing doesn't actually work that they're suggesting. Because AI is kind of notorious for hallucinating things that don't exist. If you don't have access to Claude Code or OpenAI's ChatGPT Codex, what you can do is just whenever the AI tells you something, say, bruh. B-R-U-H, no punctuation, all lowercase, bruh. And that will challenge the AI. It's kind of like a secret command. And AI will be like, oh, wait, you're right. I thought more about that. And it doesn't work. Mr. Robot asks, at what point does AI-assisted DBA turn into why do we still have DBAs? I think that if you're talking about production database administrators, people whose job it is to keep the server up and running and online, I actually think that they're protected for a little while longer because human beings, especially management executive human beings, want to be able to walk into a room, point at one person and say, why is the database down? And if it's Copilot, and that's like, that's a really good question, Bob, let me think about that, that those kinds of database administrators are going to have some time. They're going to be able to, because you're still going to want a human being involved to try to troubleshoot and get to the root cause. In terms of performance tuning, I don't know. I don't know what's the point where all of the power is going to shift over to the developers and to the production DBAs to automate performance tuning. What I will say is that with every new version of SQL Server, new capabilities come out and the AI doesn't know how to fix those problems yet. So for example, there are problems with JSON indexes in SQL Server 2025. I was just yesterday working with Claude Code on troubleshooting some of those problems that a client was having. And Claude Code didn't know what the answers were, and we were learning together about what was causing a particular issue. So those new kinds of features, we still have quite some time. And then we'll take one more. Nick says, hi, Brent. In the comment in a previous post, you said, I actually put some serious thought into deciding what tool I was going to learn next because I would have so much free time when COVID hit. I'm curious as to what you would have done and why. Is there a tool or language that you would have thought would have been in high demand? At the time, I came to two conclusions. I was either going to learn another database, just because I figured out, well, I know one database, you know, SQL Server, how hard could it be to learn another one? Or I was going to learn Visual Studio so that I could start coding. And not in order to produce applications, but just so that I could help developers understand when you do this in Visual Studio, here's how it affects the database. I wanted to be able to show them in Visual Studio. Well, so that was 2020. That was 6 years ago. I don't think that that advice holds any longer. If there was, and I'll give you a great example. So right now, there is a huge spending freeze for a lot of companies in terms of they don't want to buy consulting for a while. They've been telling their employees, just go try AI first. So what am I doing with the free time that I have when I'm not doing consulting work? I'm actually using AI. I am building stuff. I'm improving the first responder kit scripts. I'm improving the training. I am so excited. in the past with my mastering classes, I've given you a stored procedure that goes randomly executes a bunch of other stored procedures in order to simulate load, because I wanted to give you something that was like self-contained that you could run in SQL Query Stress. Well, now, thanks to AI, it's easy for me to build bad applications. It's easy for me to build a load testing application. I can tell Claude Code, here are the kinds of queries that I want you to run. I want you to run them in this mix. I want you to be able to connect to these flavors of SQL Server. I want to have a simple GUI that just shows here's the connection, you know, put in your server name and authentication stuff, and then hit go, and then here's going to show you your transactions per second and your wait time per second. So I can have a different app per class test. So in mastering index tuning, we've got five labs. I can give you five different XEs or a drop down for each lab we're doing. And you can just go in there and run the application and it'll be a much more seamless experience for you. Plus, I can do the kinds of queries like unparameterized queries that I couldn't do as easily before in a stored procedure. It's really exciting. So I love it for that. And if you had a lot of time to go learn, that is exactly the thing that I would steer you towards, is start learning how Claude Code and ChatGPT Codex works to start playing around with your own applications. Read a really interesting post by John Gruber today that was talked. John Gruber's usually comments on Apple type stuff, but he also comments on tech type stuff. And he had an interesting comment. He said, "I don't think that the amount of human written code is dropping. I think that AI is just writing so much more code now. More lines of code per day are being written than ever before. It's not that humans aren't needed anymore. It's that we're building so many more applications so quickly. It's not a fixed pool of apps that get built. It's not a fixed amount of troubleshooting that gets done. It's just that now these AI tools enable more people to build more stuff quickly." That is exactly how my own experience has pulled out. I have not, I would never have built my own applications. I say never. I did that back around like 2000, 2001 when I was a developer, but I would not in the 2020s have been building, compiling my own applications, period. And I think I did three yesterday. I think I coded three. I did Claude coded for me three applications yesterday. So I get really excited about that. Of course, these are also internal applications that would never have been built otherwise, stuff like training class-based applications. But I'm excited for that. I think it's a whole lot of fun. I think you should try it too. All right, there's a good handful of questions. It is a nice afternoon here in Las Vegas. It's that perfect time of year in the spring where I can actually be out in the sun for 20 minutes without baking to death. This is just nice up here. Plus, the temperature is really nice up here. The higher that you go up in the mountains, the cooler it gets. You see over there that there's snow over there. There's actually about 45 minutes west of the Strip. They're skiing over on Mount Charleston and Lee Canyon. And not year-round, but probably 6 months a year. You can go over there, snow over there. That's probably pushing it. It's probably 3 or 4 months a year that there's actually snow. But it's always like 30 degrees Fahrenheit colder up there than it is down in Las Vegas Valley. I'm not looking forward to in the next week. We're supposed to hit just shy of 100 degrees. This will be the earliest in the year since the dawn of recorded history in Las Vegas that it's gotten that hot in the year that quickly. The previous record was May the 1st, where it hit 100 degrees, and we may hit it this week in March. Absolutely bananas. So I am going to go tootle around around Las Vegas, enjoy the nice day out. Hope you had fun and learned something, and I will see you on the next Office Hours. Adios.